Okay, so let's start the session. The next talk is by Tirtha Biswas, and he's going to tell us about local voices and targeting.
Thanks, Harvard. So we already heard some really nice talks yesterday about dark energy, which is obviously one of the biggest puzzles in cosmology today. And there was a really nice overview on different kind of observational evidences supporting dark energy, and also some detailed discussions on two, I would say, major paradigms trying to explain dark energy. One is involving scalar fields, and the other with modified gravity. What I'm going to talk today is a slightly different approach, in some sense more conservative, at least that was the initial hope, because we don't want to put anything other than general relativity. And I should say that the story is not complete. There is still a lot of work to really determine whether this kind of a model can be viable. But all I want to, present today is that there are some encouraging indications. So the work I'm going to talk is based on these, with Alessio Notari, Reza Mansouri, Stefan here, and his graduate student Deepak. And as I go along, I will give some more references, because now there are quite a few groups who have started working on this or have been working on this. Okay, so this we already heard yesterday, and by now I think everybody knows the problems, the smallness and the coincidence problem. I obviously won't go into it, except to emphasize that this is not just a problem of the most economical lambda CDM model, but almost all models which tries to explain acceleration, the late time acceleration. So you have to put in by hand, literally, really small mass scale. It's small, and also you have to tune it such that the effect happens today. And we are still pretty much in the dark as to how to resolve this. Now, I'm going to ask, in the light of this really puzzling features of dark energy, I'm going to ask one, now it may seem superfluous, is dark energy real? So, of course, as highlighted yesterday, there are so many evidences from different kinds of observation with totally different physics. The supernova, of course, which first told us that the universe may be accelerating. Then there is WMAP, the structure formation. More recently, the baryon acoustic peaks, ISW effect, and the list goes on. And so everything seems to fit very nicely with just very economically, by just one adding one parameter, lambda. And success of lambda CDM also means failure of Einstein De-Sitter, which is just a matter-dominated universe. So at this point, how can we even think that we can, get rid of this lambda? What could we have missed? So the proposal, thanks. The proposal, as far as I know, was first introduced by Celerier, and which is this assumption. What assumption we could have missed? Well, most of the cosmological observations are based on assuming a homogeneous FRW isotropic background. But of course, our universe is not homogeneous. There are galaxies, galaxy clusters. And it was Celerier, I think, right after, the discovery of acceleration in 97, who put forward that could these inhomogeneities play a role in our cosmic evolution. So this is just, to show that we have these voids and structures all around us. Now, there are two different approaches, roughly, which has been investigated. One is this back reaction approach by Brandenburger, Kolb, and many other collaborators, which is that could it be that the structures, the inhomogeneities back react, and as a result change the average expansion of the universe? And in fact, there was some claim initially, but it's a hotly debated topic. And I think the consensus now is that it does not. But the problem in this approach is that, whenever it's a perturbative kind of argument, and whenever you get something interesting, some interesting effect, you typically are out of, you can't trust the perturbative approximations. So you don't really know. That's the problem with this approach. The other approach, which is what I'm going to focus on, is to look at, therefore, exact models. Okay, so you don't have to worry. If you find a real effect, you can trust it. And in particular, what I'm going to do is, so in these exact models, you actually can look at what people measure. Because now you can't trust FRW isotropic universe and the usual relations on how, for example, the observable quantities like redshift and luminosity distance is going to tell you that the universe is accelerating or not. Because you just don't have A of T anymore. What you observe is the redshift and the luminosity distance. There are different kinds of distances in gravity. Just pick one. This is the popular choice, which is just the luminosity of the source divided by the flux that you measure, the bolometric flux. This is just a definition. You can also, it's actually easier to compute the angular distance, but in general relativity, these two are, there is an exact relation between the two. So as long as you get one, you should be happy. And the point is that, of course, the relation, so redshift is like time and d is like distance. So once you know this plot, d as a function of redshift, you can, you know the, that gives you information about how the universe is evolving. But all our inferences, most of our inferences are just based on light and how, and light trajectories. And if you have some inhomogeneities, then that's going to affect how the trajectories evolve. So you can potentially, at least a priori, think that the redshift and the luminosity distance will get corrections. The question is how much. That's the crucial point. And whether, therefore, the inhomogeneities can mimic some kind of an apparent acceleration effect. Now, one thing I should mention, there is a one downfall of this exact approach, which is, you know, it's very hard to firstly find exact solutions and also, do calculations with it. So you typically have to use some kind of symmetry, like spherical symmetry, which is what I'm going to focus today. And so that can lead to an underestimation of the effect, because when you have symmetries, you can have cancellations. So that's actually one advantage which the back creation does not have, because you don't need to focus on just spherical inhomogeneities. Anyway, so with that, before going into the details, let's just look at, you know, how it can possibly work. So there are two obvious scales in the problem, or two dimensionless quantities, rather. One which I call this K-max, which is just the amplitude of the fluctuation, delta rho over rho, and the other is the length of the fluctuation, which I call, so I divide it by the Hubble radius, which gives you the cosmological evolution, following the cosmological evolution, so I call this L bar. and so the corrections are going to depend on some combination of these two quantities, roughly speaking. And so the important thing to note is that typically, we expect that when delta rho over rho is order 1, that happens only at very small scales, like 10, 20 megaparsec or so, while the cosmological evolution is like 3,000. So this is a very small quantity. So this is the crucial quantity which really governs your correction, and you need to know the power. What's the power of the correction? And then that will determine whether you have any significant effect or not. So how can this work? Well, actually, it was already alluded to by Roy yesterday, that there are two different ways one can think potentially it can work. One is this more optimistic and nicer effect, which is the average or integrated effect, which is, imagine that we really have, so you really have these patches, right, 10, 20, or 30 megaparsec patches all around, you know, in your universe. And light is coming from something like supernova Z equal to 1. So it travels through many, many of these patches, hundreds of these patches. And if you get a systematic correction from each of these patches, they add up, they could add up. And then, you know, the hope is that it will give you some significant correction. If that would work, that would be perfect, because you just don't need anything else. There, that's there. You should have anyway included it in the first place. The problem is, and I'll already give you the answer, is that it does not work. And one way to see is that, so the correction is governed by this Newtonian potential phi, and it goes like the following. So delta rho over rho square and L over RH square. So for something like 20 or 30 megaparsec, this is a very small number, something like 10 to the power minus 4 minus 5. And that's why you don't really worry about it. And that's one of the reasons why people initially never bothered about this inhomogeneity, if it makes sense. However, there could be a twist. Anyway, I'll talk about that later.
How do you justify that?
Well, this mainly comes from perturbative argument, and I will come back to this relation, yeah, in a later slide. So the local effect, there could be the other possibility, which is more radical, because you actually have to give up the Copernican principle, which is, suppose we are sitting on a, for some reason, we are sitting on a really large, much larger underdense region. So something like, actually 300 is probably too much. We need something like 200 megaparsec or so. Now what happens, first of all, if that's the case, just I will go through it in more details, but just roughly, locally the effect is actually like a gradient, which goes away when you integrate, because it's a gradient. But since it's a gradient, you kill off one of this power. So it's just L over RH. And this, for 100 megaparsec, is like 10% or so. So you're talking about the right kind of numbers, as far as supernova is concerned. And just the physics is, what will happen is that locally, you will get a different kind of an expansion rate than outside this patch. And that's what is going to give you an apparent effect. Sure.
So what are you assuming about the
station? I'll come to that. At this point, it's flat. I mean, outside the patch, it's going to be flat.
So we have lots of evidence, nothing to do with the luminosity
distribution,
about the ratio of dark matter to baryonic matter. And if there was time to count enough, that you fall well short of what you can see.
Yeah, so that, for example, it comes from CMB, right? One of the evidence. And
many.
But... I'll talk about many of these. I will not touch upon structure formation. That's one thing which we haven't studied yet. But I will talk about WMAP, I'll talk about BBN, I'll talk about supernova, obviously. Right. Right. The dark matter and the... It's going to be a little low. It's going to be a little low. The ratio between the baryons and dark matter is going to be a little low. But from this light curve, from this light to mass ratio, these kinds of measurements, my understanding is not very precise. There is still quite a bit of uncertainty left. So I'm not sure. Right. So we'll, yeah, right. I'll get to that. Yeah. Yeah, absolutely. No, at the moment, right, that's a very good question, but that's also a very interesting point, an interesting way to discriminate, actually, this model from something like lambda CDM. So at this point, what I'm going to assume is that we are absolutely located centrally. As a first approximation, we are... Yeah, it's... Oh, yeah, that's absolutely true. I mean, that's true. That's you have to violate the Copernican principle. I mean, of course, there is a, I mean, it's like not like you have to sit exactly at the origin, but basically the constraint is you have to be within 10% of the radius. So. That's right, right. So basically the dipole of the CMB is going to give you the most stringent constraint that you have at this point. And that, once you take that into account, you see that it's like a 10%, you can be like a 10% away from the center, roughly speaking.
So what about the, I mean,
right. Well,
you could even do an unconstrained fit when you imagine tuning your axis relative
right.
to the center of the void,
right.
splitting those parameters.
Well, the thing is that if you have, I will. Well, there are two. Well, the one thing which I will come in a moment is that there is a difference between the local effect and the integrated effect. So when you see from CMB, it's going to be integrated effect. And what that happens is that it suppresses enough that you have, for example, the stringent constraint that you get is really from the dipole. So what happens is that if you're slightly off-center, your dipole is like 10 to the power minus 3 or so. And then progressively, if you look at all the other multiple moments, they go like 10 to the power minus 6, minus 9, and so on and so forth. No, I'm talking about once you are off-center, you will see a dipole, a CMB dipole. And that's the stringent constraint. I mean, that's everything else goes like L square. So it's like, anyway, we'll come to that. No, I think it's very interesting because it's such an unconventional idea that there are so many things you think that something will go wrong, but so far at least it seems you can get around it. But yes, there are some wishful thinking, like what you're saying, that you have to be very close to the center. Okay, I guess I already covered this point. So first, since it's a workshop, I thought I will give one technical slide as to the model, which is a spherically symmetric LTB model. So there are these two functions, S and R. And so these, you don't know exactly, I mean, you know exactly, but only implicitly through this relation Q. So you know R as a function of the radial coordinate and time. So this should be a dot. Just to give you an intuitive flavor, so this R is like a scale factor which depends on the radius. So it obeys something like a Hubble equation here. So if you just substitute R as small r times the scale factor, I mean, you know, this is just an intuitive thing, then you see it's like h square. And this is like 1 over a cube. So it's like the matter dominates. I mean, it's coming from the dust. And this goes like 1 over a square. So that's like curvature. And the only function you have here, actually there are different kinds of LTB models. I'm going to focus on only one class where you have only one undetermined function, this k of r, which is roughly like a curvature which can vary as a function of your radial coordinate. So this is the only tunable thing that you have. And roughly speaking, the evolution is that corresponding to every R, you have an FRW evolution. Okay, but it can vary, the curvature can vary as you go, move outwards. There are some consistency conditions. For example, if you want to match it to an FLRW background, the K prime has to vanish at the edge. And that actually imposes that the total energy density is roughly the same inside the patch and outside. There is not too much of a difference. It's just the distribution is obviously different. And if so, you can work with an open, you can match it to any open universe or a flat universe, but for simplicity, and we know that we have to match to CMB, so we choose it to be to match to a flat background. And I just wanted to point out that we want, since there have been, there was quite a bit of debate as to whether this effect is real or not, we wanted to study a model where we can make both numerical and analytical progress. And we could do that here, just to mention, because firstly, you can do a Smalley expansion and know R exactly. And the Smalley expression actually can still describe a density contrast which is large. Okay, so you can even see the structure formation scenario. The Zeldovich approximation comes out nicely. And for small perturbations, you have the usual tau squared growth of the perturbation. So it's a nice model of structure formation as well. And you can also do a more non-perturbative Taylor series kind of expansion, because U is just tau cubed type, depends on this particular combination. And therefore, you can, and using this, just these arguments of how things are related, I mean, how R depends on tau and K, the functional form, you can make various arguments, like what kind of power you would see as corrections in your redshift and luminosity distance.
So what is the matter in this point?
Just matter, non-relativistic dust.
Just
dust. Yes, same info. Okay, so first I'm going to talk about the integrated effect. So this is like a Swiss cheese model. You can think of small patches covering your universe. This is the void, and then there are these filamentary structures, ring-like structures. And so you can solve the photon trajectories through these voids and also calculate the distance. And this is the upshot. No. It's just under density. And it's controlled by, let's, I call it K-max. You can tune it, 0.3, 0.4. It's not uniform. It's a profile. So the density contrast varies as a function of R. You have the minimal, you can consider all kinds of situations. But the simplest thing that we look at is that you have a minimal under density exactly at the center. And it's roughly constant. It's roughly constant, but then again, then you have a structure to compensate for the void, and then it matches on to the background. So I should have probably drawn a figure of the profile of the density.
People were trying to discuss structures of fractals, so mm-hmm. more annoying tessellation. So I'm just wondering.
I am not aware of it. Yeah, that would be interesting. They may have some results already.
Well, it was based on that, but it was a bunch of
astrophysicists. I do need a spherical symmetry at this point. But it would be nice to avoid the symmetry. I mean, I'm stuck with spherical symmetry, actually, because you know, it's very difficult. So. Right. Right. Now, as I mentioned, like, there are two different ways you can think the inhomogeneities can work. One is that you have an integrated effect that there are lots of small patches like this. And light comes from somewhere here, and it passes through many, many of these patches. And you get pick up corrections systematically from each of them. And that, the hope was at least that that will give you a shape of the luminosity distance versus redshift curve, which would mimic acceleration. So first I'm describing this. And the other alternative, you mentioned that there are these two different in your talk as well, that the other approach is that you give up the, so this actually does not violate Copernican principle or anything. You can just sit anywhere. And this is just the realistic picture of our universe in some sense. Well, I mean, this is a toy model, right? And so, you know, if these are randomly distributed, firstly, well, let me look at the correction. Anyway, it doesn't work. So, but, no, it doesn't work because actually the anisotropies, everything is much smaller. Even the anisotropies would be very, very suppressed.
But are these holes 10 megaparsecs? Or
this is 20, 30 megaparsecs. I mean, right now, you know, L is a free parameter in our model.
Does it matter whether it's 10 or 100?
Yes, it matters. Because that's the crucial thing here. So, if you look at, so in order to understand the integrated effect, you put the observer here, let's say, and then the source is diametrically opposite, so that the light has to travel through structure and the void to reach us. And what you find is that, okay, so this is the FLRW or FRW piece proportional to the length. But then the correction, the crucial point is that the linear term is missing. That's the cancellation, and you only get this L bar square. A piece, and that's very small for 30 megaparsec or so, because L bar is 30 divided by 3000. So it definitely matters what's the scale you're looking at, but realistically it's a small scale and therefore it's a very small correction, the same in the luminosity distance. And it does add coherently though, as you see, and we actually check numerically that this L cube dependence is right. So even if it adds coherently, that kills one L bar because you're summing over many patches. You still have something. If you're looking at a redshift of one, it's just a correction of L bar squared, which is very, very small. With luminosity distance, there is a little bit of a twist, and we are not sure completely whether it can give anything interesting. The twist is, I should mention that we calculated this, but we didn't exactly point this out. We didn't realize this fact, which was first pointed out by the Greek group, Tetradis et al. So the luminosity distance, this is an additive thing. So these things just add. But in luminosity distance, the correction appears, if you look at the details, in a multiplicative way. So this L, the distance, it corresponds to the distance of the source. So, if you are looking at some supernova which is situated at z equal to 1, it's almost close to Hubble radius. So, instead of L L bar squared, you get RH L bar squared because it multiplies the correction. So, this RH also multiplies the correction. And now, if you have many of these voids, so each of, and they add coherently, you get only an L bar correction. So, that's actually much larger. It's probably still too small, but it's much larger and probably more interesting. But the problem is that there is this flux, photon flux conservation idea, I mean, argument by Weinberg, which is, you know, the total amount of flux that you see should be the same, whether you have an inhomogeneity or not, if you're looking at the whole sky. So, in some place, you will have a little less flux, and that will give you a different, a bigger distance, but in some other place, you will see a larger flux. So, on average, it does not have any effect. Absolutely. Absolutely. Exactly. And
we
wrote in one of the papers, we have this plot where we consider this kind of Swiss cheese thing, and you see that it fluctuates so much, it actually explains, apart from all this application, it explains the scatter, the why you have such a large scatter in the low redshift supernovas. So that's one thing this can explain. Right. Okay. So So there are actually other applications, even if this does not explain dark energy. So now I'm focusing on the main scenario, which is suppose you are living on this large void, order 100 megaparsec. What if? But obviously, I mean, the first question is, you just told me that there is 10 megaparsec. That's what we expect. So where did we, this void origin from? Originate from? And that's, and let alone staying in the center. So that's an issue. I mean, I don't have a good answer. Nobody has. But, and you have to live with it. But we are trying to solve, you know, the cosmological constant problem. So it's a tough ask anyway. But I will just put some of the things which seems, at least to me, it's kind of encouraging. Which makes me at least optimistic regarding this scenario. Well, firstly, we need under density not of around 1, only something like 40% or so, which helps a little bit. Then the thing is, this has been known long back, that we regularly observe voids which are much larger than what standard growth of structures predicts. We observe 50, 60, even larger voids. This is what even Roy discussed yesterday. And in fact, Peebles and Goopser think that this is a real problem in a standard model. They have their own model to explain these larger voids. But there is at least some kind of attention. Then, of course, there is this huge Great Sluan Wall, which nobody knows why it exists. And it's huge. It's like 400 megaparsec or so. And it, no, this is like a, this is a structure.
That's the biggest structure.
That's the biggest structure.
Yeah, but if you look on that scale, there's lots right. of voids.
So sure.
And other filaments on smaller scale. So that fact that there's something that's 400 megaparsecs is irrelevant.
Yeah, but this, see, the thing is, this is a, okay, this is a funny thing, but it, there is a nice coincidence, it's probably just a coincidence, that the redshift of this, so it's, redshift of this is around 0.08 or so, 0.09, which is precisely what we would need to, I mean, that's the extent of a void that you would need. And then we need a compensating structure. So you, in our scenario, see, we need, we don't need, so it's not like that we have a big void and everything is uniform. Realistically speaking, that's not the case. We just need that over a large, something like 150 radius, megaparsec radius, you have a under density, but there could be structures and smaller voids inside that. That's perfectly fine. But there is an overall under density which spans something very close to where the Sluan Wall stands. Just a coincidence. And then you would expect some kind of a compensating structure. I mean, in our model, of course, it has to be spherical, but I mean, that's just a toy model. So that's the, right. Yeah, it's not empty. Right. It has some typical density. Yeah, it has some average density, and you know there are voids, there are structures, voids inside it. That's perfectly fine. I'm just interested in like to simplify my life. I'm just going to consider one scale, but you could have. Well, people have not studied it. I mean, in the sense that. That's a very good point, and that's the thing which is resisting us from doing an SDSS fit directly. Because the growth of structures... So what happens is that, since you mentioned, I'll just digress a little bit. So inside the void, inside this patch, for mostly it's almost like an open universe. But outside you have Einstein Desiderat. So the growth of structure will be different, and one has to put that in when you actually do an SDSS thing. Yeah. Well, people, right. Yeah, but people have not combined the two things, right? What you have to do is to, if you look at the full data set, which is typically going to be, some of the stuff is going to be inside, some of the galaxy clusters are going to be outside, and you have to, you know, model the, so you have to take into account that the growth of structures are different in one of your data set, and outside it's a different thing. And then you have to run your code.
The other question I have is, the small structures form first. How can you make the small structures in the normal way, and then the bigger structures form later,
right.
And therefore the
that's an interesting point. But yeah, nobody knows how the void originates anyway. So that's the, I mean, for example, one idea which would support your point would be right. Yeah, but such a big void, that's the problem. Like if you use you know, the standard primordial spectrum and evolve. You're happy with having such a... Okay, that's great. that's true. I mean, it could be just, you know, lucky fluctuation or unlucky. But it could be that we are just by chance there is this, you know, we have a bigger structure than we usually expect. It could be. If that's the... Right. Right. Yeah, I mean, that's something I would have touched on. The thing is, you're absolutely right that... So there are two... let me say it now. I would have said at the end of the talk, but there's roughly two different ways you can think of having these voids. One is, well, actually three. One, as Paul mentioned, that maybe it's a chance. I mean, you just have a very low probability of having such a void, but, you know, it can happen, and maybe there is one. The other thing is that you put something by hand, some kind of feature in the primordial spectrum. It's interesting, there is some work by Sarkar, you must be familiar, where he tries to put this bump. Okay. Well, the funny thing is that it's exact, the bump roughly coincides with the scale, you know, the scale at which the bump, the exactly at the scale where we want a power. Well, there is also a bump. We had this discussion. We didn't. He said that there could also be a bump around 100, 150 that they put in.
Right.
No, even the third year data they analyze. Okay, I did not know about the. Right. That's it. Yeah, that's not going to be particularly useful. Right now actually we are trying to see whether we can put a bump, but the upshot is that it's probably not going to, as you're saying, it's probably not going to give you the full effect. It's tightly constrained and I think if it works, it's probably a combination. I mean, there's also this other thing which... Okay, so this is what the point that I would have mentioned, is that there are studies of percolation of voids, where the smaller voids can form bigger voids. And this is one study which found in lambda CDM, you get something like 100 megaparsec, which is smaller than what we need. But once you... it's a mystery at this point, and I'll leave it with that, but... There are avenues which might give you, which might make the scenario a little less unlikely than what you naively would expect. That's where I would say. And in fact, let me quickly mention some of these other funny things. This was also very surprising when we realized that there is a group which claims that they have actually found a hole, an underdense region, which is spanning something like 150 megaparsec or so. And there is a 25% underdensity in the clusters. Then there is a very much more recent paper, which is in trying to explain the cold spot in CMB So it's a, the location of the void is not, you know, around us, but far away. But again, you have, finally they found that in order to explain this cold spot, you need, they observationally find that you have a void roughly of this size, and then that can apparently explain the cold spot. So, so anyway, I'll leave it to you to take your take on what you think. But there are, I mean, this number of 150 seems to pop up in many places. Okay, since I'm running short of time, let me just quickly try and summarize. So, firstly, of course, if you, the bigger the void, one thing is clear, the bigger the void, the more difficult it is to explain. It will have some effect on CMB as well, and recently there was a paper by Caldwell and Stebbins, which says that the really big void spanning up to Z equal to 1, which is what you would naively expect to get rid of supernova, because to explain the supernova data, because they go up to redshift of around 1, but they are excluded. But the nice thing is that at least at this point, I mean, things are changing because data is being added to the supernova plot. But most of the data are either in this local region, the nearby ones, and the other ones are in the high redshift region. And the acceleration effect is really a mismatch between this expansion rate in these two regions. So if you could modify any one of them, it can work. So you don't need to modify the curve all the way up to 0.5, Z equal to 0.5, but something Z equal to 0.08 or so, which is roughly 200 megaparsec. I'll talk about this. So right now, this is just supernova. Yeah.
One practical point.
Right.
It's supernova
is detected quite slow. Yeah. That's absolutely right. So we are actually waiting. Their data is not yet out. Yeah, so I have to, I mean, we are waiting for the data. Once it's, I mean, that's going to, that may already rule out this model. That's possible.
Best thing at this stage, best thing would be that we just ask clarification questions, because we are half an hour a day for this session, and then we can start from scratch on the list of objections and list of problems, because that's what this should be about anyway. So.
Okay, so quickly the physics, it's probably already obvious. So here is, you know, the one big patch, and you have the background FRW. So we are living in this underdense region, and then there is this ring-like structure which matches smoothly to the background. So there are two ways of thinking about it. The way structure formation works is that underdense region is going to become more underdense, so there is an extra stretching of space. So that gives you an effect that the expansion rate, the Hubble expansion rate, is larger than outside. Another way to think about it is that all the particles are being attracted to this ring-like structure, so that adds a radial velocity locally. It's like a Hubble slope. And now you see, obviously, we have just switched time with radius. So if you look at the expansion rate here and here, there's an extra expansion rate which will look like as if universe has accelerated in coming from here to there. So it's simple physics. It works. What we wanted to do is, you know, what is the minimal void that we need in terms of the size as well as the under-density contrast, because bigger and larger, you know, under, it becomes more difficult. So here is just the chi-square plot. The only thing the supernova depends is this ratio. You know, H in, that's it's a very robust thing. Doesn't depend much on the profile, etc. It's just the ratio of the expansion rate outside and inside. And so this is the Ries data that we looked at. And you notice, just because of the data, that there are these some kind of jumps here. And you don't improve things very much beyond something like Z equal to 0.08 or so, okay? And roughly the you get a maximal good fit around this value 1.2 or so. And by the way, this ratio is directly related to the density contrast. So there's a direct relation. So this, in order to produce 1.2, you require something like 40 or 50% under density. So here is the supernova plot. So a couple of things I wanted to point out here.
What is delta M?
Delta M is related to the luminosity distance. It's like a log of luminosity distance. So this thing, actually the intercept gives you the Hubble rate, the local Hubble rate that you measure. Now, the red one is just Einstein D-sitter, just homogeneous case. Green is lambda CDM. And this is our void model. So one thing is that these two things obviously become parallel after the void, as you would expect, because the corrections are much suppressed. And another thing I wanted to mention is that even the lambda CDM and, you know, these is roughly are very close together. They don't change much once you're out to something like 0.5 or 0.1 redshift around that. And that's why, roughly speaking, if you can match for the high redshift, the Einstein D-sitter with lambda CDM, you would get the high redshift supernovas to work. But where you would fail is the low redshift one, because in order to match lambda CDM with Einstein D-sitter, the Hubble parameter which labels them has to be different. And in particular, this one, the Hubble parameter sits way here, which is going to miss all the local supernovas. So what this void does, it just, you know, interpolates between these two, and that's why this thing can work. But obviously, this feature and here, it's different compared to lambda CDM. So that's why I think I am saying that it can even rule out, even can be ruled out in 6 months. So it's not going to hang around. Now, since several questions obviously have been asked, no one really did WMAP. There were several papers written on, including ourselves, as to the fitting of the supernova, but no one looked at WMAP, and we wanted to see whether things can be consistent at all or not. And also there was this question of the local Hubble parameter that we measure, whether that can be consistent. So partially, I guess people think that it's a daunting task because you have an inhomogeneous universe. But that could give you secondary effects. Since I'm running short of time, I'm not going to discuss them. There could be interesting secondary effects in CMB, but basically because it's an integrated effect, typically they would be much more suppressed, and that therefore the CMB anisotropies, you can arrange that you won't see them. Of course, if you're off-center, which typically you would be, you would see a dipole, and that's what I was referring to. This was by Elnis and Amar Gui, who mentioned that, you know, this constraint puts you in a 10% radius, limits you to be in this region. But then everything else is much small. All the higher multiples are much smaller. The other interesting thing is for a time we worried about whether how can we get an ISW effect, which seems to have been detected. But again, locally you have an open universe, so it's not Einstein D-sitter, that contributes. And also if you have many voids, then they can add up. Okay. So for my purpose, I'm just going to completely ignore all the anisotropies by sitting at the center. And then you are just left with Einstein D-sitter because all the corrections, as I mentioned, are very small. And this, I'm not the first person, or we were not the first person to try and see whether an Einstein D-sitter can give a decent fit to WMAP. There is this group by Sarkar and Soradip, I know. Could be others who have tried to see this. And basically the answer is that you have to give up scale invariance. You have to add some feature to your primordial spectrum. And what we wanted to do is just an illustration. So this is just a toy model. We did the simplest thing possible. We just added running, which anyway people include often, and see what kind of, you know, whether we get any decent fit or not. So here is the fit. This green one is the lambda CDM. This deep blue is just Einstein D-sitter, which obviously is a poor fit. And then these two lines are, this blue one is just Einstein D-sitter with some running, and the other one, we put some curvature, open curvature, just for fun. Actually, it starts to improve the fit quite a bit It's just we put 5% by hand. So, so the conclusion was Damned Acidium is a better fit. There's no doubt. But it still gives a decent fit. So you can't, of course, the key point was that the Hubble parameter that you need for this fit is much lower. And that's why people don't consider, I mean, Einstein De Sitter, because you need a much lower Hubble parameter than what you, what measurements suggest. Well, this was around 45. But this is, you know, the nice thing, another nice thing. Well, what now happens is the local Hubble parameter is not this. This is the average Hubble parameter. But locally, there is a factor 1.2 or 1.25 that you have to multiply. And So let me just quickly go through, you asked some of these questions. So what we get is the baryon density is given by this, which is consistent with BBN. This is the point that you were probably mentioning, that we do get that the ratio between baryons and dark matter is a little low. It could be too low, but we are still, and also this is just one possibility, I mean, one feature that we added in CMB, but anyway, I mean, this is something which potentially could be trouble. It is definitely in trouble, and I will comment on that. So this is okay. We have a low spectral index. The baryon acoustic oscillation, I'm going to talk about in detail, gives one constant on the total matter density. That actually seems to work. But what will not work? I often don't remember, but we just use, yeah, it's, yeah, but we are, okay, so the view that we have taken here is that it's just running in a very short, just what we observe. I'm not going to, yeah, I mean, it's just what we get, and basically, we are not going to say that, you know, this is what the value is, or this is the running all the way, obviously, as Richard pointed out. I mean, I don't remember at this point, I'm sorry. Yeah, but on the other hand, these have really large error bars also, which I didn't include. For example, in a 2 sigma level, it almost goes up to 0.9, and this can go down up to something like 0.05 or so. Right. Yes, right. So, but I can tell you exactly the zero point. And I mean, the view here is just that, okay, we model the simplest way possible the primordial spectrum only in the region that we observe, and things could be different outside it. And or there could be some other feature like a bump, which also has been proposed. But this is just one modeling just to see whether it can work at all or not with the Einstein distributor. Yeah. You have a question? Okay, good. Okay, so the other thing which was a nice thing, that we needed H to be much low, but once you account for this jump, as I will show, you can almost go up to 59. I mean, this is a 2 sigma thing, but you can go up to a pretty high H. So, you know, it just worked in the same way. You needed a local expansion rate to be larger for supernova. And then you found that, and then you find that the same thing actually helps in making the discrepancy between the local Hubble measurements and this WMAP fit. Not probably to the extent that you would want, but certainly this is reasonable, given that there are so many different, I mean, the measurements of the Hubble from different measurements do give you a wide range of numbers. For example, the supernova gives you a lower number like 0.59. Hubble, HKP is obviously much larger. Right, right, absolutely. But there were, we found some papers where that's absolutely true. In supernova, usually you don't worry about the, you don't worry about the intercept. But there, I think you can get a weaker constraint, and I don't remember often which paper, but this is from one of the supernova papers. I think one of the earlier ones. The later ones don't talk much about the precise Hubble parameter. Okay, this is just a plot of the same thing. You have this local H, and this is H out. So this band comes from supernova because that really gives an error in the slope of these parameters, while H out comes from WMAP. And you see you can almost go up to 0.59 or so. Okay, so this is the another very wonderful achievement, modern cosmology, which has been discussed already in details yesterday, so I don't want to go into the details. So roughly speaking, you have this galaxy power spectrum, and now you have this peak, baryon peak, coming the CMB as a signature of the CMB that you see in the galaxy spectrum. So this obviously depends on what your primordial spectrum was. It depends broadly on the scale of matter radiation equality and also the sound horizon at CMB, because you really are measuring the angle of the sound horizon at CMB extrapolated to the sample, which is around z equal to 0.35, divided by the distance, the angular distance. So you can actually then backtrack and get that luminosity distance. You already know the redshift. So that gives you one more point in some sense. So now this is very tricky in our model to do this, because again you have the same problem. Some of the samples fall inside the void, and also something which is unclear to us is in the analysis done by Eisenstein, they use lambda CDM, and they also mentioned that they used a fiducial cosmology to convert the, so to speak, the co-moving distance to this physical distance. So that has to be redone in Einstein De-Sitter or this local void for the given sample. So one cannot take the constraints at phase value, and we have to redo this calculation. But if you just naively do it, just to see what happens. So there are two constraints that define. One is this on matter density, and that apparently works because of this low spectral index that we have. Again, I mean, with this naive thing that you do, if you just, you know, with this naive analysis. But what doesn't work is this distance that they measure at z equal to 0.351370 with this uncertainty. Initially, we thought actually it works, because the thing is, you notice that, so in lambda CDM, if you compute the ratio of the distance at this redshift of lambda CDM cosmology and Einstein De-Sitter, you find this quantity. It depends on the, you know, the Hubble parameters of the two curves, and around 1.2. And if you remember, that's what we needed, around 1.2, the ratio, the lambda CDM and Einstein De-Sitter, to get the supernova to work. So we thought for a while that it works. But the problem is that there is inconsistency between the WMAP value of H, or the local value of H that we get, at most can get something like 5.9, whereas what they, the constraint that they quote, usually there's a H, you know, divided by H factor, but in their paper they don't have that H. It's really an absolute error, irrespective of what value of local H that you have. And this number comes if you use H around 0.65 or so, which means, but in our case, H is much lower, so that's why we miss. So that's where it stands. We cannot at this point fix this problem. Could we do better, though? Firstly, again, one has to redo this calculation and this analysis. And the, but, you know, my gut feeling is that if this whole thing works, you have to somehow make sure that the H out that you get from CMB, you still get a decent fit with slightly higher H, something close to 0.53 or 0.54. That would also make you better as far as in more consistent with the local measurements of the Hubble parameter. And, you know, this baryon acoustic problem will also go away. So, so anyway, this is something which we are working on, and we'll see how far we go. Okay, conclusions. So we looked at supernova, WMAP, the local measurements of Hubble, BBN, etc. These seem to work. What we have to do now, the main thing is, you know, to study perturbation, the growth of perturbation inside this void. And there is some work which is being done, which already, you know, it's a recent paper which came out by Zibin, who have started looking at linear growth of fluctuations, which we would need in order to study this. And once we have that, we'll see whether it can be consistent or not. The other thing, as I mentioned, that you probably need to fit WMAP with a slightly higher H. And then, of course, there is this huge issue. If everything works, then the paradigm shifts, and we start talking about how this void exists. And I already discussed this, so I'm not going to go into the details. Maybe a combination of all this. The good thing is that there are already so many constraints, and this model is not going to hang around. So it's just, you know, either it works or it doesn't work. The two big issues, whenever at least I give a talk, is that, you know, the origin of the void and this violation of Copernican principle. But as I mentioned, it's not going to hang around. The DLZ curve differs quite a bit from lambda CDM. One can actually, I'm told that some collaborations are already trying to look at direct evidences of voids by just counting galaxies. But one smoking gun evidence would be that, well, we would not expect a spherically symmetric void, so there would be some anisotropy, which would lead to anisotropy in both the Hubble measurement or the basically the luminosity distance redshift plot and CMB, and they should be correlated. So that's what we should happen. That's a smoking gun thing. It's very difficult to get this in any other way. I think that's where I will end then.
Yes, you already had questions. So I propose that we just divide this into three parts. The first part, we'll just have some quick clarification questions or something like that. The second part, maybe we can go back to what you told. Can we just go back to last one? First point, the last transparency, that this thing can work. The audience probably have reservations about.
Yeah, that approach is more like the back reaction approach. He doesn't talk about a specific exact model. And I think the effect he's talking about is interesting. It's I still have to understand it. It has to do with how time evolves in different, once you have inhomogeneities. And his claim is that the time will evolve differently if you have inhomogeneity versus if you don't, and that can account for this apparent supernova, I mean the apparent acceleration effect. But it's on the it's in the back reaction category. He doesn't exact solution. Well, of inhomogeneities. Basically, if you have some inhomogeneities, he looks at how time evolves differently, and then he tries to do an averaging process if you have lots of inhomogeneities of small size. He's not considering this you know, large void scenario.
The value of
Yeah, I mean, you know, basically because in order for CMB to work, I mean, he doesn't look at the full W map, but in order for CMB to work, you have to have this low value of H. I mean, if you are sticking to Einstein DC2. So I think that's a common thing.
Other questions? So let's start with this. There are a lot of questions already, but maybe we can revisit it.
You had some questions. Absolutely. Right. I mean, actually, one suggestion was that if you have significant non-Gaussianity in the spectrum, you could even that might help produce these voids. Yeah. So, but that. Right. Yeah, we haven't looked at, you know, the how exactly it affects. But that's in the pipeline, I would say. Yeah. Right. At this point, our point was to kind of illustrate, to see whether, you know, you can at all fit WMAP or not. So we didn't really worry about how you get the spectrum or, you know, because... I mean, that's something I would love to explore. No, I mean, I would love to explore this, because this was actually Robert first mentioned to me that if you have non-Gaussianity, that might help. And we just, so I would love to explore this possibility, which we haven't done. It may help. My feeling is that, you know, probably a small effects would add up to, if you want to not invoke chance, then I don't see one particular effect being able to explain everything, because then it's going to be a dominant effect and you would have already seen it. But on the other hand, I mean, I was really encouraged with this percolation mechanism, because it's true, if you have, you know, something like 30-40 megaparsec voids, they can percolate. And in one study in Lambda CDM, already you have, say, you can create 100 megaparsec void. But now you throw in, you forget about Lambda, so that should already enhance the situation. Plus, if you add in some other physics, like, for example, what Peebles and Gupser had, some kind of a fifth force, which they used to explain a 50 megaparsec void, but now you want something more, but, you know, one has to play around with it, I guess, to see whether it can work or not, or non-Gaussianity. Yes. I mean, all I know is that there are some people who are actually trying to detect the void. I mean, there are some groups which I mentioned, like briefly, that who have actually looked, tried to do some kind of cloud, but I'm obviously not, you know, an expert in that. So, but they try to actually count, and they claim that there is some underdensity of, you know, around 150 megaparsec scale or so. So again, I do not know what is the state of the art in doing these galaxy counts, but, and I'm told that there are some groups which are looking at it more carefully. Well, right. Well, there are two things. One is that, firstly, you have this locally. Since you have an open universe, you would get some ISW effect. And the other thing that we have started to think about, I mean, which tells you that really the universe is very inhomogeneous and bubbly at this particular scale, at some scale, something like 150 or so. In that case, what will happen is that you have like lots of these, you know, underdense, overdense region at this scale. And what that happens is that now phi is going to evolve because you are going to have this Ries schema effect. And so now you would get an ISW effect, even though you are in Einstein D sitter, because just because of this large inhomogeneities. So again, the question is, you know, how large it is, and you know, actually going there and fitting the data, but it's possible.
I think it might be sort of a good idea for the non-expert audience, if somebody could tell us
Right. See, we have a low H. We have low H. Well, I showed you the so one is, say, some constraint coming from BBN. Okay, so that's just baryon density, which I, in our WMAP fit, it agrees. Then there is the issue of the ratio which you observe from local observations of this light to mass ratio, which gives you omega b versus divided by omega m, and that what we get is something like, you know, 9%, which should be around 13% or so. So there is a discrepancy there, but you know, how seriously you take it or how worried you are, I do not know. But no, I guess you should be worried about it, but you know, the problem with those, my understanding is that they have lots of it's not very precise at this point. Yeah. Right. See, if you, okay, so let me put it this way. The total matter density is not too different in the two models. That's the funny thing, because you have omega m equal to 1 as compared to omega m equal to 0.3. But on the other hand, you have much low H, because so if you compute omega m times h square, which is what you typically measure, the total density. Right. Yeah, but I mean, you have to actually show me the different numbers, because like from what, So the main observations that we looked at, I will tell you, is that we first looked at BBN. Okay, that's fine. We looked at the from this large scale stuff, typically you get this ratio, the light to mass thing. So you get the ratio between baryons and matter, dark matter or total matter. And you get, you know, for example, even BAO gives you omega matter times H square, a constraint on that. And you have the CMB. So we looked at all of these, and I just showed you the numbers that we have. So right. I'm not. Yeah.
So, what are the two things you're saying?
So, sorry.
He has a very big still plus a run, so that means his power is dropping off.
Yeah.
Much, much faster than conventional.
Yeah, I think what we have to do is that probably what will happen is that once you put everything together, like all the data sets together, we are not going to get this. If at all it works, it's not going to be this kind of running and with this kind of tilt. So, but we just didn't do it because of this problem that many of the, we need to understand how structures grow inside the void. And so my answer to your worry, I mean, a worry that I have too, is that one really has to do it. I mean, do the whole thing, and then probably a consistent picture would be closer to the usual scenario, I mean, the usual numbers for example, the primordial spectrum. Or perhaps what the other thing that we are playing around is that we have a bump kind of thing, which already seems to work because, you know, Sarkar and all, they already looked at that. In fact, except for supernova and baryon acoustic peak, everything works for them. And and they even looked at, by the way, they also looked at structure formation. But their spectrum is a little different. They have almost a scale invariant thing, but they have this bump at some scale. And they claim that they can even get a better fit, but of course they have more parameters, but they can get a better fit than that lambda CDM model to the primordial spectrum. And they can fit what you're worrying. SDS is the structure formation and matter radiation equality, those kinds of things. So our effort was really to see whether it can work at all or not, but I'm not going to push that, okay, this is the spectrum and this is the modeling that will work. But I know for sure that they look at everything else apart from supernova. And we, in fact, included, just because they get everything, we also included our analysis of the supernova to see. So their problem again is that they have a much lower H, but once you throw in this void stuff, so you can firstly get the supernova to work, and also you can push up the local Hubble parameter. So they have something like 4-5, again you can go up to 5-57 or so. So the two things probably need to combine.
Gaussian distribution and a resonance peak. And, you know, of course, one way to model that is to take two Gaussian power spectrum and involve them in a way to get this very short peak. So you've got to run it at a very short range and non Gaussian. Completely Gaussian with a resonance peak. And that resonance peak. So if you have a
Imagine having a Gaussian profile, and then I have a pole, and that pole itself is a Gaussian.
Yeah.
Yes.
That was just a simplified mathematical. That's exactly what it does. But what I'm saying is that's exactly what you see with the resonance, a resonance, and a, like the pole of the dummy propagator. It's exactly that. Because you have a Gaussian distribution, right? It's a convolution rather than something. So it's
and so then you can explain why these other problems have to be here and see what it was and shape of different
objects. No, it isn't physical. So yes, when I literally use the word resonance, I actually just kind of infer to the physical methods.
Actually, that's what also they discuss. I mean, basically, if you have a phase transition, you can get this kind of spike in the spectrum. Yeah. The other comment I wanted to make about this structure formation is that you do need to add some other stuff, like you need to add some warm component of dark matter in order to get the SDSS to work as well. Yeah, that's something I'm not...
I think he's talking about the fight.
It's an artifact. Yeah, I mean, well, basically the thing is, you know, if you just look at what kind of power you expect at this scale, something like 150, so you expect delta rho or rho to be something like 0.05 or so, whereas what we need is something like 0.4. So that's the basic problem. No, it's not a problem in lambda CDM. It's just that if you want to explain this, I mean, I'm not even talking about lambda CDM. So even in CDM or whatever, if you just try and extrapolate from the standard primordial power spectrum, you know, what kind of delta rho over rho you would get at this scale, something like 150 or 200 megaparsec, it's very small. So to have a bubble like this is extremely unlikely from that point of view. That's what I was saying. Okay, I mean it's probably a standard calculation that you can do. I don't know exactly of a paper, but we can definitely look at something if we tell you precisely.
Okay, so
it's
time to get to your talking.